We are going to start our show in just a minute or two. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. This is Hemp Rising, and we have a very, very exciting guest for you all today. This is going to be an epic show. We're going to hear some really good stories. I think some of you have maybe never heard of, so definitely ping your friends in. You definitely don't want to miss this show. Oh, you know what? I thought I made a mistake for a second. Josh, good morning. Josh, you there? Give us just a minute, people. We'll be right with you. We're getting our room set up here. We have a very special guest for you all today, Mr. Joseph Hickey, who is, if you don't know, one of the truest definitions of a hemp pioneer, I think, that you can get to. He's been involved in the movement for, I think, now 3 or 4 decades, maybe more. Joseph, I don't want to... I don't want to get too deep into the topics we're going to cover today without Josh here. Is he, Josh, are you joining us yet? Are you on? You live? We might have a technical difficulty here. Hold on.
Sorry, Milan. I'm here. How are you this morning?
Okay, good. Good, good.
As usual, it was user error on my part. Good morning, Joe. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast today. Welcome to Hemp Rising. You may have to unmute yourself in that lower right-hand corner.
Oh, okay. Does that work now?
There you go.
Okay. I'm like you, Josh. Sometimes I'm technically challenged when it comes to technology.
I was talking up a storm this whole first 3 minutes, and then I'm like, oh, right.
I'm glad to be with you guys this morning.
Well, we're excited to have you here. Normally we have a little bit of chit chat until about 8:05 as we get ourselves together. It's amazing how early the morning comes. But we haven't floated away yet. Milan is in LA and I'm in San Diego, and as yet we're looking out, and gratefully the sun is out today. So all the Southern California folk will be able to go back to functioning as normal. But we're thrilled to have some rain. It's always the challenge. I feel like living in Southern California is like being a farmer. You know, when it's not raining, you're worried that it's not raining. Then when it is raining, you're worried that it's too much rain. So it's always a bit tough. But you know, we only get about 7 inches of rain a year here in San Diego. So it definitely, when it comes down, it creates a mess. But I'm excited to have you here. Now, you're based in Kentucky.
Yes. I'm born and raised here in Kentucky.
Okay, great. And per your bio, what led you to the 1942 Kentucky Hemp Growers Cooperative Association? How did you discover that, and have your kind of hemp awakening?
Well, it's kind of like, you know, everything in life for most people, you know, everything is happenstance. And I had a company down in Central America in Belize, and the government changed on us. We lost all our contracts, and, you know, I ended up leaving about $2 million worth of equipment down the jungles of Belize. Came back, and, you know, you kind of think your life's kind of over that you knew, and you're wondering what the heck you're going to do next. And my father was an antique dealer, and he collected all this, you know, stuff. And I had about four of these books of newspapers. They bound them up each month. That was the way, you know, before computers and everything, that's the way they kept their records or their archives. So I'm going through, and one day, you know, I was reading about Lindbergh flying, you know, from New York to Chicago to Atlanta to Miami down into Belize. And I was like, you know, I've been to Lindy's Landing down in Belize. I was going, you know, and so I was finding all these things interesting that was happening back then that you really don't see in the history books that much. And I turned the page one time, and I saw where F.G. Clay was resigning from the Kentucky Hemp Growers Co-op. And it hit me like a ton of bricks because, you know, we've got the Kentucky Tobacco Growers Co-op, but never heard of a Hemp Growers Co-op. So I get reading, and this F.G. Clay was going to Washington, D.C. at the behest of Roosevelt. And he was the one that ran the Hemp for Victory program for the federal government. Yeah. So, and I'm like, you know, so that was kind of the toe dipping into the water, wondering what is going to happen next. How deep is this water? And little did I know that it was going to be over my head before long. And the more I looked into it, I found out my grandfather had grown hemp for, you know, and then the more I looked, my friend's grandfather grew hemp. There was a hemp processing facility here in about 10 miles from here in Versailles, Kentucky, and another 15 miles in Winchester, Kentucky. And, you know, when I was cutting tobacco growing up, you know, 17, 18, and you would see hemp growing along these fence rows. And back then we thought, well, look at all this marijuana out here. And so, but, you know, I knew the difference. And so I kind of grew up with the notion that, you know, this hemp was here, but no history behind it. So now I'm really getting into it. Found a hemp processing equipment in Paris, Kentucky. And then all these records that they had there at, it was a mill, a granary, but they had like four of these, you know, tall file cabinets full of all these hemp records. And I was going through and I saw where the Navy was buying hemp, you know, from, it was Spears and Sons Feed Company. And I was just blown away. You know, every time I looked somewhere else, I found something different. And I found those guys through Dr. Hopkins, who wrote the book about the history of hemp in Kentucky. And, you know, I sat down and talked with him. And he said, you know, you always knew when it was time for harvest because you had this sweet smell in the air here in the city. And that's when the pollen was floating around. There was so much pollen, so much hemp growing, you know, you couldn't go outside without smelling it. And so I had all this information, started collecting. This was in 92. And so from 92 to 94, you know, I was collecting all this information. We were going out, and a buddy of mine, Dave Spalding, worked for the University of Kentucky in the ag department, and he taught farmers how to grow vegetables. So he knew all these farmers. And so I talked to Dave, and he said, yeah, he said, there's hemp growing all over the place here. So I said, well, let's go ahead and go out and collect all these seeds, because at some point, they're the heritage, you know, they're the, what, you know, because China Mington was like back in the, during the war, Kentucky was growing a variety for fiber called China Mington. And that was supposed to be one of the best seed varieties out there. And so we were collecting all these seeds. And one day, it was in 94, I turned the radio on. And again, you know, all this happenstance, you know, you just, you know, it's kind of like you're falling into history. And the turned the radio on, and I don't listen to the radio that much. It's, you know, so it was just happenstance. So I turned the radio on, and I hear the governor. Well, the governor was having Open Door at 4. Burton Jones was the governor back then in 94. And so I thought, you know, I told my wife, I said, we got all this information. Let's go down and sit and talk to the governor and talk to him about, you know, trying to get hemp brought back for these farmers. Because back then, that was when you had all of these heads of the tobacco companies swearing in front of Congress that nicotine wasn't addictive. And so we, you know, I was seeing the writing on the wall, and I'm thinking back then, you know, well, hemp would be a great replacement for tobacco. And so I told my wife, let's go over there. And she said I was crazy. And finally I talked her into it. We go over there, and you have to sign up and tell them what you want to talk about. And I sure in hell wasn't going to tell him I want to talk to him about hemp. And so I told him I wanted, you know, you had to write down, and I said, you know, the plight of tobacco farmers. And so, you know, I get in there, and there's probably 10 advisors in there with him. And my wife and I sit in front of the desk, and he said, well, you know, we introduced ourselves. He said, what brings you here today? And I went, well, Governor, I said, you know, the writing's on the wall with these, all the stuff going on with tobacco. And I said, I think we're going to probably end up losing tobacco as a cash crop for these farmers, and we need an alternative crop. And he said, well, what are you suggesting? And I went, well, Governor, I said, you live on one of the premier hemp farms back in the, you know, the 1800s up into the 1940s. And, you know, he could see his kind of eyes open up a little bit. And so I started telling him about Europe, what was happening there. England was just petitioning their, you know, their government. What was his name? Ian Lowe. And so I talked to Ian, and Ian said there was a guy in Canada, Joe Strobel, that was doing the same thing. I called Joe, and so I had all this information. Clinton had signed a executive order that listed hemp as a critical material, and I had photos, all this information. And then I think the one thing that really stood out, you know, in his mind was the equipment in Paris, Kentucky, that underneath one of the combing machines, there was a big pile of fiber that was underneath there. And I'd taken it out on the back porch, and got a hammer, and sit there all day and beat it into a pulp and made paper out of it.
Oh, wow.
It was like tobacco. I mean, Bible, you know, how it rattles, you know, that real fine paper in the Bible. It was like that. And I said, Governor, do you have a piece of paper, writing paper? And he looked at me and went, kind of strange. I said, yeah. And he gave it to me. And I laid that piece of hemp paper, and I tore off an exact same size as a piece of this paper that I made, hemp paper. And I said, do you have a match? He looked at me. He didn't know what was going to happen. And so he said, yeah. So I gave it to him. So I lit his paper, and it burned up, and there was an ashtray there, and it left this big black ash. And then I lit the hemp paper up, and it just went poof, and it was just a tiny little gray spot. And he looked at that, and he was like, you know, you could see in his mind, he was like, well, in reality, it didn't mean anything, but it just kind of got his attention. And he looked at me, he said, well, Joe, said, if you were governor, you know, what would you do? And I said, well, governor, if it was me, I would form a task force to look into, you know, what I've shown you here, whether it's true or not. And he said, well, Joe, he said, I don't have any doubt what you're telling me is true. And I said, well, governor, it's not so much that. It's more of public perception. If you say it, then, you know, it's one thing. But if you form a task force to look into it, then it gives validity to it. And he looked at me, he said, Joe, said, I think you're right. And he looked over at his ag guy, Jim, I can't think of his last name, but he said, Jim, he said, I want you to work with Joe. And he said, let's do this. So after that meeting, you know, I'd been collecting seeds, and one of the seeds that we were farmers who were collecting off was a farm that was owned by the Graves family. And Jake Graves was one of the people that started National City Bank, and he was the chairman of the board, and he had just resigned, and, you know, he was the chairman emeritus, but he was a top, you know, one of the top civic leaders, you know, in the area here. And Andy, his son, was the president of the Fayette County Farm Bureau. And so, you know, Dave and Andy were friends, and that's one of the farms that we collected on. And so we went in, and, you know, they knew that I was going to meet with the governor. And afterwards, I went in and sat down with Andy and Jake and Dave. And I said, you know, we want to do something with hemp. And I started telling him about it. And he's going, he said, you don't have to tell me anything about hemp. He said, look at this picture. And there was a picture of him when he was 16 years old. His dad had died. And he was weighing up hemp out in the field. And he had a suit on and a hat, you know. So he said, I know all about hemp. You know, you don't need to tell me anything.
Wow.
He said, what do you mean to do? And I said, I want to reincorporate the Kentucky Hemp Growers Co-op. And I'd like for you to be the chairman of the board. And he went, sure. Yeah. He said, I'll do that. And I said, Andy, you'll be the president. And I said, I'll be the executive director. So that was how the Kentucky Hemp Growers Co-op came back into existence from being dormant for over 50 years. You know, I think it was formed in 1942. So I guess by 44, you know, they'd shut everything down. And so that was the beginning of the governor announced the task force, which then put the spotlight on Kentucky for hemp. And so we were going out, you know, Jake got, you know, and it was a mistake that happened that would have changed things. But the governor asked Jake to be the chairman of the task force. And he thought it would be a conflict of interest with him being the chairman of the board of the Kentucky Hemp Growers Co-op. So he declined, but he was still asked to be on the board. And so that this other guy came in. He was not really a farmer, but he had a lot of farm-related companies and real wealthy dude. And he just proceeded to railroad everything that we tried to do. We went to Indiana, what was it? It was Inland Container. They were up on Ohio River. And one of the task force went and met with them, and they said, yeah, we would definitely use hemp, because if they use hemp fiber versus wood fiber, they use less of it. And it made, because what they were doing is taking cardboard and reconstituting it and making pulp out of it again. But you had, when you reconstitute it, it loses strength. So they were adding more wood fiber to it, but they could use less of the hemp. But anyway, the chairman of the board had told us, he said, if you get a Fortune 500 company, then we'll do something with this. But he was, you know, he was just a stick in the mud when it came to anything else. And so this, one of the board members, Gail Glenn, who had talked with him, went to the chairman there of the task force and said, I've got a Fortune 500 company. And he still just, you know, at the end, he and his secretary wrote the report and handed it to all the board members and said, this is a report we're going to the governor. And Gail, Glenn, and Jake, and some of the other people, I think there were three or four of them out of the 12 that were farmers. And they all said, we're not going to vote on this. You know, we haven't even read it. How are we going to vote on it? But because this guy had so much pull politically and financially, the other members of the board voted with him, and that was what was sent to the governor, and it ended the task force. But it really served its purpose because it was basically a PR move as far as I was concerned. And so from there, you know, we'd gone to county fairs and Farm Bureau meetings, and we're talking to all the farmers. We built a board around the Kentucky Hemp Growers Co-op, all known farmers, you know, good farmers that had a history. And so we were getting PR, we were doing all this. And then one day the phone rings and it's Woody Harrelson. And Woody said, you know, I'd like to come in and meet you and see what you're up to. He said, we had a mutual friend. And so, you know, Woody comes in on a Tuesday. No, he called me on a Tuesday, came in on a Thursday, and we hung out. And then Thursday evening, he called Laura, his wife, and Denny was only a year old then. And so they flew in on Friday and stayed until Tuesday and left. So Woody just said, look, I'm here to help. You know, tell me what I can do, how I can help. So from there, you know, we started to do a few things together, and we came up with this idea because Kentucky had, unlike the federal law and all states, they had an exemption, or you know, in there for hemp. You know, marijuana is this, except for, and then they all had the exceptions. And Kentucky had taken out that exception, and we're the only state that had done it. So we look at that as like an advantage, as something we could use to create more awareness. So Woody had just finished shooting the People versus Larry Flint, where Larry Hess was testing the law on the First Amendment. And so we decided to test the law. And again, you know, everything we did was focused on educating the public about, you know, the benefits of hemp and the history of hemp that we had here in Kentucky and really all over the country. So we orchestrated this whole, the whole thing. We got a county attorney that agreed to prosecute the case. And, so we got him, he agreed to prosecute it. So if we won, he would, appeal it. If we won, or if he won, we would appeal it. And we would appeal it back and forth till we got Supreme Court. So,
wow.
Yeah. So it, what ended up happening is, you know, we go down, it's about an hour and a half from Lexington. We drive down and met with the county attorney, and he had some land down there. And because we had to have some place to plant it, and, you know, so what he did, he didn't want to, have him involved in it because he was going to be the guy that was kind of prosecuting this thing.
Right.
But he had a farm, and he said, "What we'll do," he said, "I'm going to deed an acre of it to my daughter, and then my daughter can do a 1-year lease to Woody on the property." So that's how we end up with an acre down there to plant in. And well, I'll go back because this whole thing was, you know, like I said, we were just trying to educate everybody. So we had the first International Hemp Conference in Lexington on Saturday. And so we had people from the Ukraine. We had people from Australia, England, Canada, France. And so we brought all these people in. And one of the guys that we were working with, that he was actually the executive director of Greenpeace. And Ted Turner had come and he'd hired him from Greenpeace. Ted was giving away, like, I forget what it was, $200 or $300 million back then. And he was in charge of giving that away, Peter Behoof. And so Peter was, you know, we were getting grants from the Turner Foundation. We started the Hemp Museum and Library, and he funded a van to travel around in, and we could go to these different, you know, farm bureaus and all these other places that we were going. And so we talked to Peter. He got some of the people from then. It was the Turner News Network, I guess. So they had the reporters and cameramen come up. And so now we were going to have TV coverage for this thing. And so on the Friday before, we set up an event at Simpsonville Elementary School. And so we brought all these experts in and went to this. Donna Cockrell was the teacher that ended up in a whole lot of trouble over the deal. But we put on this thing for her class and planted a tree. So we got on the front page of the newspaper on Saturday. And Saturday was when we had the conference. And so we had the conference, which was a great success, packed house. And so on Sunday, we had the front page again for the conference. And then on Sunday, we took the news crew down to where we were planning, and they filmed the planning. And, you know, I caught Woody had the seed. We had certified French seed. That we were planning just to make sure that, you know, if there was any issues, we had backup. And it was a funny story. Woody's got 4 seeds. I call the cops. They show up. And, of course, you know, they knew I was going to call. And so, but they show up, and the sheriff comes out there, and Woody had already kind of dug around in the dirt and made a spot to plant these seeds. And he shows up and he said, "What's going on here?" And Woody says, "Well," he said, he opened his hand up. He said, "I got 4 hemp seeds here." And he said, "I'm going to plant them." And the sheriff just kind of looks at him. And Woody goes down and drops them in the ground and kind of pats them in. And he looked at the sheriff. He said, "Well," he said, "I guess that'll do it." And the sheriff said, "Well, Mr. Harrelson," said, "do you realize that you're under arrest?" He said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, would you retrieve those seeds?" And so, funny, Woody's down there, you know, because the seeds are the color of dirt. And so Woody's like digging around, like, and he's like, "I can't find them."
That's so, what, you can't find them?
Right, he couldn't find them. And so the sheriff said, "Well, you know, that's okay, you know." And so he handcuffs him, puts him in the car, you know, and we had to all agree that they were hemp seeds, you know, because they couldn't find them. They didn't have any evidence, but we admitted to it. And so that started from 96 to 2000, we had 4 years of PR. You know, every time they had a hearing for the case, and the first one at the district court we won, but it was kind of the way they did it was convoluted, the way the judge did it. But we appealed because it wasn't exactly right, so we go to the circuit court, and it just happened that this, you know, and we didn't plan this. We didn't know where we're going to end up in court at. But a buddy of mine was a circuit. And so when it came for the hearing, I called, it was Judge Bill Trude, William Trude. And so I called Bill up and I said, Bill, I said, you know, we got this case coming up, you know. He says, "Yeah," and I said, "Look, I want you to rule however you're going to rule. I don't, you know, I'm not asking you to rule one way or the other, but I would like to have it on this date." And he went, "What?" He said, "I'm going on vacation that day." And I went, "Look, I've never asked you for a favor. I've never, as long as we've known each other, I've never asked you a favor, and." But, you know, I said, "You can go the next day. It won't be so crowded." And he finally went, okay. So they noticed it. And so we have the trial, or there's a hearing, I guess. And he rules that Woody is, you know, not guilty of planting marijuana, you know, because it was obvious that, you know, that was not the case. And so the next day, the newspaper, the headline is, because when he was found not guilty, I told Woody, I said, because you had all the newspapers and everything. I said, "Woody, when you go outside, I don't care what they ask you, if you love your mother or whatever, just keep repeating, today is Independence Day for Kentucky farmers." He went, "Why?" I said, just do it. Just do it. And he went, "Okay." So he goes out and he said, "Today's in it," you know, and he just kept repeating it. And then the headlines in the paper the next day was Independence Day for Kentucky farmers. It was the 4th of July.
Oh, wow.
And I thought about this weeks and weeks ahead. And I told Woody, I said, you know, the headlines in the paper after this thing is going to be Independence Day for Kentucky farmers. And he said, "How could you possibly know what's going to happen in 4 weeks from now?" And I said, "Well, you just remember that." And, you know, he just kind of blew it off. So the next morning, I'd gone into town early and got five or six newspapers. And I threw one down, woke him up, and he went, what? I said, "Look at the paper." And it said, "Independence Day for Kentucky farmers." And he looked at me and he says, "I can't believe it." And so anyway, so we had, and there's a lot of different things that happened through this whole thing, Josh. And I'm telling the short version of it. But, you know, through those 4 years, we got, you know, we did Woody. Let me back up. We had gone to legislators and tried to get a bill put in, and they said, "Look, we're not going to, this is, everybody thinks hemp is marijuana," and said, "We wouldn't touch this with 10-foot pole. Everybody think we're trying to get marijuana legal." And he said, "Till you educate the public, you know, we're not going to touch it." So I think it was 97 or 98. Because we had been banging this thing in the paper and getting all the PR. So what we finally decided we ought to do is do a survey. So we got the University of Kentucky Survey Center. I think it was like $2,500 to add a question into all their surveys. So it comes back that 78% of Kentuckians somewhat or strongly favored allowing farmers to grow hemp. So we took that survey, and now we're taking it to the legislators and saying, look, people know the difference. They want to allow the farmers to do it. And so in what it was found, because we ended up, we actually did go to the Supreme Court, and they remanded it back to the lower courts that, that did the final adjudication when it was found not guilty. But that was in 2000, and they, we tried to get a bill passed then, but we just, you know, we got the House, we got, you know, enough votes and got it passed through the House, but the Senate was an issue. So in 2001, you know, we went at it again. And this time we met with, it was David Williams was a senator, Senate president. And we met with him, and he said, look, because he didn't think we could get the votes. You know, he just didn't, he just couldn't imagine it. And he said, look, if you guys get enough votes, if you guys get the votes, I'll let it hit the floor. And we said, okay. So we did all the lobbying, and finally we had like two or three more votes than we needed. And we tried to meet with David Williams, and he wouldn't meet with us because he knew if we were meeting that we must have, you know, have the votes, but he wouldn't meet with us. And he wasn't letting it hit the floor. So Governor Nunn, who we, you know, had been helping us, Governor Nunn and I had been friends for years. He was the governor when Nixon was in. And that's a whole nother thing. All the stories he had told me about being in the White House, that's a whole different thing. But he, I went and saw him because he did, actually he did the closing statements in Woody's last trial. And I'll tell you this story real quick. So he's, I asked the governor, I said, will you do the closing arguments for Woody's trial? And, you know, he was a law and order dude, anti-drug, all that, but he knew what hemp was. And he said, sure. He said, I'll do that. And so we met it at the governor's mansion that he was living in, all the attorneys, and planned out everything. But anyway, so when it comes time that morning for the trial, I gave him a hemp bar. And I said, Governor, I said, you know, if you have an occasion, can figure something, a way to use this, you know, use it. He put it in his lapel. And so, you know, he's talking about, you know, that Woody's, what he's doing is to help the farmers. And he starts talking about, do y'all know about jury notification? You know what it is?
Absolutely.
Of course, but you can refresh it for listeners.
Well, I mean, you can't argue that the law is wrong. And you can't say, well, what the governor was saying is, look, you know, he was looking at the jurors. He was going, you guys are the last bastion of that protects the people from unjust laws. And he said, if you think this law is wrong, he said, then you, but the judge never, I mean, what's he going to do? Stop the governor from, you know, governor, you can't do that. But he let the governors keep talking about, you know, that the law was wrong. And so then he's talking to him, and he reaches in his pocket and pulls out that hemp bar that I gave him. And he said, ladies and gentlemen, jury, and he said, with permission of the court, didn't ask permission. He just said, with permission of the court, and he starts opening it up, and he takes a bite of it. And he's chewing it, and he's just looking back and forth at all the jurors, just looking, you know, just like chewing it, looking at them. And it seemed like forever, you know. And finally, you know, he does a big gulp, and he looks at them, and he says, ladies and gentlemen, jury, he said, if you're going to convict this man right here, he said, you're going to have to convict me too. He said, because I got it on me, and I got it in me. And you could see the jurors are like, you know, they were like stunned.
Wow.
And the way he closed it out was, you know, like, again, this is 2000. He said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, he said, you've heard my esteemed colleague, the prosecutor, Tom Jones, say that the only reason Mr. Harrelson is here is to make, is to legalize marijuana. And Tom Jones is at his desk and he's writing like he's busy. And the governor's talking, he walks right up to his desk. And he said, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, he said, if I thought that for 1 second, he raised his hand up, he slaps it down on the table. And he said, I'd be sitting at this table right here. And, you know, Tom Jones jumps up and, you know, everybody was like, you know, because he slapped his hand hard. It didn't like sound like a gun going off. And that's how he ended it. And the jury goes in and the jury comes out. And that's, you know, they're coming out and I'm looking at them. And because I'm sitting right beside Woody. And I said, Woody, it's not guilty. And he's, how could you possibly know what their verdict is? I said, I'm telling you, it's not guilty. He said, how do you know that? I said, they're looking at you. I said, if they find you guilty, they wouldn't want to take you. They wouldn't want to look at you. He said, do you think? And I said, so that was how, you know, we was the gut. And I give the governor a lot of credit.
What a story. Oh my goodness.
So the following year, this is where Governor Nunn comes back into it. You know, they weren't letting us have the bill hit the floor. So I go and to the governor's home and, you know, I tell him what's going on. I said, you know, David Williams isn't letting it, you know, he told us he'd hit it. And he said, do you have the votes? And I had a card there that had all the senators and who we had. And he looked at it and he said, are you sure? I said, yeah, all these guys said they would vote for it. He said, hop in the car. So we hop in the car and he drives 90 mile an hour where he goes. And so it didn't take us 15 minutes to get to Frankfort. And we go up to David's office. He just walks in, says hi to the secretary and walks straight to his door. And the secretary says, governor, he has somebody in there with him. And he looked back at her. He said, that's fine. And he grabs the door and starts open. He said, Joe, said, just wait right here. And I went, okay. So he goes in. And about 3 or 4 minutes later, this guy walks out. And then another 4 or 5 minutes later, the governor comes out. And he said, let's go. And we go out in the hallway. He said, it's going to be heard on the floor tomorrow. And so Governor Nunn was the reason we got the bill passed in Kentucky that, you know, allowed research. Because when we did the bill, we knew that if we tried to get hemp, the bill to allow farmers to grow hemp, that it was never, that wasn't going to pass. So what we decided to do is make it a bill for university research. And by that, you know, because we were telling the legislators, you know, you can't vote against research, it's just research. And they all said, yeah, we could vote for that. But what I did, at the end of that bill, I put a sentence in the very end of the bill. It said, Kentucky immediately adopts any and all federal rules and regulations pertaining to industrial hemp. And of course, who can argue against that? Because if it's legal in the federal, why would we care? You know, and so the bill passed. And so now when you fast forward to 2014, when the farm bill was passed, because of that one sentence, Kentucky didn't have to go back in like all the other states and come up with some kind of a hemp bill that would allow them, you know, they didn't know how to figure it out, but we were just using the federal rules and regulations. So we were the first to be able to get out there and plant. And we had seeds that we had named after Woody's daughter, Denny. We had seeds in Canada because Woody and I started a company called Kinex in 98. And we had taken, I was going to say we smuggled seeds to Canada, but really we just, you know, FedExed them up. And so we took those seeds and we had a Hungarian hemp breeder that crossed it with a Hungarian variety, and we got the Denny seed out of it that was certified in Canada. And the Kinex went for 4 years, and we were doing everything. We were doing fiber. We were doing food, making stuff out of the hemp seed. We were doing oil. We were doing toasted hemp seeds. And then we were sending tractor trailer loads of hemp seed to into the States for the bird industry. And we were sending, we were making these bales of fiber, but, you know, you can make money off of it, but it's not really the value added. So we bought a matting line. And so we were mixing polypropylene with hemp fiber and making this matting, and we were selling it to Indiana Biocomposites that was making car parts out of it. And what started this whole cascade that ended up shutting the company down is the DEA came in and said, you can't send live seed in the United States. And you need, because we had already shipped like five or six loads, tractor trailer loads. And they said, you got to get those back in or we're going to sue you. And the seed was already gone. The birds were probably already eating it. And so we end up suing the DEA, going through court with those guys. But that started the thing where now every time we brought a load of matting that was going to Indiana Biocomposites, they were stopping it and, you know, looking at it and trying to see, you know, so they would hold us up for a day or two. And Indiana Biocomposites was a on-time manufacturer. So you had to have the stuff there or the whole plant couldn't continue to work. And so it happened a couple of times, and then, you know, Biocomposites said, we can't do this because, you know, we can't operate like this. So we lost that contract. And so it was just a cascade of stuff that happened with the DEA and Customs. And finally, we end up shutting it down in 2002. But we had that seed up there. And it's another long story because it was eight or 10 years before we brought it back here. But we thought we'd lost it, and then we found it again. And so we shipped it back down here. And so and some of the seed, we don't know which one because we had seed, a bunch of seed that we collected from all around. But we think the genetics was probably pretty close to the same because that's what we were going as a China Mington. And so on the Graves farm that some of the seed came off of, we planted that Denny back in that same area that the original seed came from. So it was history kind of repeating itself. And another thing that happened, that history repeating itself, which we didn't find out until later, was that Jake's, you know, Mr. Graves, it was the head, he was the head of National City Bank. His father had collected all the hemp seeds in Illinois, Missouri, Indiana, Iowa, and he had really cornered the market on hemp seeds. And so when the war started, I guess he thought ahead and knew that seeds were going to be important for the war. So he had all these seeds stored in a tobacco warehouse. And they came back, the government came in and confiscated all his seeds and distributed them back out to the farmers to grow hemp for the war effort. You know, they grew they had a plant in Versailles and one in Winchester that was processing all of it. But they confiscated all the seed, and the way they redistributed it is all these farmers got together and started the Kentucky Hemp Growers Cooperative. So the Kentucky Hemp Growers Cooperative was the one that got the seed and spread it out to all the farmers. And we didn't know this until later on. But ends up, the Kentucky Hemp Growers Co-op that basically took Jake's seed and had it replanted 50 years later, or, you know, whatever it was, 60, 70 years later, Jake was the chairman of the board of the same company that basically took the seeds from the government that had confiscated them from his dad. So stuff like that you couldn't make up.
That's crazy. Now, Joe, did you anticipate back when you started this thing that it would take as long as it's taken, that it would be another 15 or 20 years before the ball really moved forward? Did it seem like there was energy to fix the system?
Yeah, no, I think the main issue that most people had that got into the industry, and, you know, John Rulak, I don't know if you guys have heard of Nativa. They were a big company that sold hemp seed and different, you know, stuff to do with hemp. And he ended up, you know, had a $100 million company before it was over with. But he did a survey. I think it was in 98, I think. He did a random survey of, you know, all the people in the industry when you thought hemp would be legal. And, you know, because of everything we were doing, I would think, you know, my guess was 2000. But the difference in, you know, that was a guess for me, but, it didn't make any difference. I didn't care, you know, when it was going to be. I just knew I'd be there until it happened. And so I really didn't have in my mind, like, you know, I can list 30 people that got into it knowing that they were going to make a lot of money in a few years, and, you know, it was going to be legal and they were going to be titans of the hemp industry. And when it didn't happen after 2 or 3 years, they just gave up. And to me, it was more, I never looked at it as a way of making money. I looked at it, the reason I got into it basically was to help the Kentucky tobacco farmers. And so I never had that vision of, you know, making something, because, you know, all these people were making hemp chips, hemp clothing and all this. And I never did any of that. I was just constantly, you know, doing stuff that was going to allow the laws to change to make this thing happen. Because even where we are today, even though, you know, you can go out and work with, you know, get a license to grow it and everything, it's still not an easy thing to do. And I tell people, hemp is kind of like soybeans were, you know, like George Washington Carver and Henry Ford and all those guys were working with soybeans. And, you know, they were looking at that as a new cash crop for the farmers, but it took 40 to 50 years for soybeans to become a mainstream crop in the United States. And so we have just, you know, we're at the precipice of the beginning of now. And, you know, people ask me, said, well, where should I put my money? Where's, you know, and I was going, look, at early stages, where the smart money goes is in technology. Because technology always drives industries. And, you know, we've got, like, they're starting to do building stuff, insulation, and they're everybody's starting to build the machinery and come up with technology that's going to allow the industry to flourish. But we're just starting that now. So I think it's going to be another 10 to 15 years before hemp really becomes what I would call a commodity. And the way it will start is little pockets everywhere. Like here in Kentucky, we've got Toyota and Ford. So at some point, somebody's going to come in and build a factory that processes hemp fiber and turns it into material that they can use for car parts. Because we've got that here, and in different states, you have, you know, different industries that can use hemp in it. And when those technologies are developed and start to be utilized. Because even when you come up with a new technology, now you've got to build it and you got the prototypes, and then you have to make the improvements on it. Anybody that thinks, you know, well, hemp's legal now, you know, the industry's going to take off. And it's not. You know, it's not going to take off. You don't have the issue that this industry has always had, Josh and Milan, is the chicken and egg. You know, do the farmers grow it first and then sit and store it and wait for a manufacturer that can manufacture it? And is a manufacturer going to build a plant unless they have the farmers to grow it and somebody to sell it to? And is Toyota or Ford going to buy it until they know that they can get the quality, the quantity, the price, and most of all, a guaranteed supply chain? Because if I'm Toyota, unless I know that I'm going to get an uninterrupted supply chain, I'm not going to do it.
And right.
So there's a way of breaking that chicken and egg deal. And that is to go to Toyota or Ford or any of these big companies that have the need for a natural fiber or natural material and say, look, this is a 10-year venture that we're getting into. But to start it, what we need is we need you guys to sign a contract, a purchase contract, and you put in all the stipulations that you want. You can put in, you know, the material has to come within 5% of what you're paying now. You have to know that you've got the farmers that are there. You have to know that the price, the quantity, the quality. Once you have all this, gentlemen, once you can meet all of this, we'll buy from you. And until then, we won't. And you say, well, what's the impetus for Ford or Toyota or any of these companies? What would be the impetus for them to sign a contract like that? And the impetus is they now have one of the best advertisement PR campaigns that you could ever get for basically for free. Because now Toyota can put an ad out, you know, we're here to help the American farmers. You know, we're here to support the American farmers. We're waiting for you. And then we've got contracts open if they can be fulfilled, if you can meet these things. And so now they get this great PR because they're here to help the American farmers, and it doesn't cost them anything. And if we don't perform, there's no harm, no foul for those guys. But as long as they're out there saying, you know, we're here, you know, you meet these criteria and we'll buy from you. That's the only way that you're going to end up breaking this chicken and egg thing. Because once they do that, now I could go and get investors and put the money together to build a facility, knowing that they will buy it. Do some prototypes, send it to them, tell them what the price is, and when they okay. And now you organize the farmers, because the farmers would love to have another crop. If they could rotate hemp through their fields, and if it didn't make any money at all, if it didn't cost them anything, they could pay for their fuel and their time and the wear and tear on their tractors. It would be farmers would love to have another crop like hemp, especially because of the deep root system, and it's it kills there's not a host for cyst nematodes. So in Canada, they were getting more like 10 to 15%, some people 20% more yields in their soybeans, because if they followed it with soybeans was followed after hemp wipes out these cyst nematodes. And so they would get more. So, I mean, and there's just, it helps the soil out. It conditions, it breaks the soil up, and it's a great rotational crop. So it's a benefit for the farmers if they don't do anything but just pay for the their expenses for planting it. So, you know, there's just so much that can be done. It just has to be done in a way that makes sense for everybody involved.
That does make sense. I mean, I sometimes get to worrying when people start expressing concern about getting into the industry to make money. And, you know, not everybody can afford to be a gentleman farmer. So there's got to, you know, I think we always have to differentiate between people that are in it just to make a quick buck. If it's not an economically viable crop, it won't ever be successful.
Right.
You know, it's got to be profitable for farmers. But I think the idea of the green rush that hit in 2019 certainly wooed a bunch of people in. It was a little bit like the gold rush where everybody ran thinking they were going to make a bunch of money. And if you've seen the history of the gold rush, it didn't turn out quite that way for a lot of those folks.
No. And you know, the people that come in and think that they're going to do that. I've had numerous people over the years saying, you know, I'm going to come to Kentucky and I'm going to buy me a farm and start growing hemp. I'm going to retire. I'm going to sell everything. I'm going to retire, come to Kentucky, buy a farm and grow hemp. And I always tell them, did you just hear what you said? You're going to come and retire and grow hemp? I said, those two sentences don't go together, because being a farmer is not a retirement. That you're coming down to buy a job that doesn't have a market for the product that you think you're going to grow and make money off of. You know, you're going to come down here and buy a farm and end up losing. You know, what they say is they said it about a bunch of different things, but, you know, and I guess you can say it with hemp, is, you know, how to make $1 million in hemp, start off with two.
Yeah. We always say that about horticulture. We joke that, you know, I came up in horticulture and we say, what does it take to make a small fortune in horticulture? A large
right.
fortune.
Well, and you know, you talk about horticulture, Jason, the issue that people don't understand, because you have a lot of people, you know, saying, you know, they mix hemp and marijuana together, or medical marijuana or recreational. And the thing that people have to get through their brains is to understand it's two ways of, and I won't call it farming, because horticulturists aren't really farmers. They are horticulturists that deal with plants, but they deal with this plant right here and this plant right here. And they're taking care of like 150 plants. Or if you're a horticulturist in trees, and you may have, you know, 500 trees out there, but you're looking at each tree. If something happens to that one tree and it's not doing right, you know, you cut it down, you plant something else there. But farmers are not horticulturists. Hemp is an agricultural crop. If you're talking, and I don't even say marijuana anymore, or medical marijuana, recreational, any of that, what it is cannabinoids. You're either cannabinoid farming or you're fiber and grain farming. One of the two. So you're not, you know, you got to get it out of your head that, you know, oh, well, hemp and marijuana, you can grow them both, but they're not. You know, you can go out and look in a field that's a fiber crop and you can tell that it's a fiber crop. And if it's grown for medical marijuana, then they're planting all females. If you're growing a seed crop, then you got males and females in there, and it's going to pollinate, and you're going to have seeds. And that's not what the cannabinoid industry is looking for. The cannabinoid industry wants those buds without pollinating, because when they don't pollinate, they keep excreting the cannabinoids, that the sticky stuff that will attract the pollen. And so when they don't get pollinated, they're going crazy, like, oh, we got to get pollinated. Let's create some more sticky, you know, let's create some more cannabinoids to attract it. And so it's two completely different models when it comes to agriculture and horticulture. And if people understand that one is a cannabinoid crop and one is a fiber and seed crop and herd, then it starts to make people understand what we're dealing with here. You know, we're not against the industrial hemp farmers are not against marijuana or our horticultural farmers. They can do that. But when you convolute the two together, it doesn't make any sense, because out of every 100 farmers out there, maybe one is a horticulturist, maybe. So anybody that's trying to get hemp and marijuana legal at the same time, or cannabinoids, it doesn't make sense, because they're not even, it's like comparing apples to oranges. You know, they're grown two different ways. They taste different. Right. You use them in two different ways. And so if people understand that one thing, if they don't take anything away from what we're saying here today, is to understand that you got cannabinoid farming, and then you have farming for fiber and seed and herd, which is going to be 99.9% of the farmers out there that it's going to help. You know, the cannabinoid farming is not going to help all these farmers, and that's what we're in here for. You know, it's to help the farmers. It's to help to start an industry that's going to allow farmers to stay on the land and to be starting to be a source for industrial materials. That's what it's all about.
Well, and that's one of the challenges that I see for the crop generally, is that there's so many variations on it.
Did I lose you guys?
Nope, we're still here. Can you hear us? Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Josh.
Okay.
Okay. Can y'all hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
Oh, okay. I don't know if y'all, they just got quiet after I said that. I didn't know if y'all heard everything I said or not.
No, that was great. My challenge, I think, for a lot of these folks is that because hemp, there's so many variations on the theme of hemp.
I lost you.
I think that, Milan, can you hear me all right?
Yep.
Okay.
I lost what, I don't know if you just went blank.
Okay.
You said your challenge and that it went blank.
The challenge is that there's so many different things you can do with hemp.
Right.
And so that makes it, it's not as straightforward a crop like so many other crops where,
went blank again.
You know, it's still early days. Okay. Thank you, Marco. It might be your connection. Joe, if you, I don't know, Milan, do you think it would help if he went to a lower quality audio?
Yeah,
or just try bouncing out of the room and coming back. Like, see the little peace sign at the top right. Leave quietly. Just click on that, Joe, and then
You'll
come back and just pop back into the room. You'll see the room.
Well, can you all hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah, we can hear you now.
Good.
I didn't know if it was you all or me, but. Might have been the earbuds. I probably wore those things out, maybe.
I know mine have paid their dues.
But what I didn't hear, you said the issue with people is that there's so many uses for it, and then I lost you.
Yeah, it's hard to wrap your head around how many different things hemp can contribute to. And so I think it's been a longer journey, in part because it is such a versatile crop. And on some level, you kind of sound like a crazy person. No matter what's the question, hemp is the answer. But Joe, we've talked a lot about history. Tell us what you're working on now. What is taking up your time going forward? What's your plan?
I guess I lost you guys. I don't know if you can hear me or not.
We can hear you. We can hear you.
Yeah, Joe.
Okay. I got you now.
Yeah.
Okay. You hear
it
now?
What are you working on moving forward?
Well, we started a new company with a technology that will infuse, well, in this case, cannabinoids, but, you know, any, what do I want to say, anything that that is a phytonutrient, you know, mushrooms, we can infuse anything into a lipid with hemp is what we started out. Can you all hear me?
Yep, you're great.
Okay. Yes.
Okay. So we can infuse anything. It could be ashwagandha, you know, any plant material. We can take that and infuse it into any lipid. It could be anything from hog fat to butter to hemp oil, coconut oil, down to, you know, watermelon seed oil, any lipid. So we started off with the idea of infusing cannabinoids or CBD into hemp oil. And just by accident, we found that it has more use of that because it originated from a culinary process. And
Joe, I'm sorry. When you say hemp oil, you're referring to hemp seed oil?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, hemp seed oil. And so that's how we started off. But again, by happenstance, somebody said, can you run a Roni berry through this thing? And I hadn't heard of Roni berries. And basically, they look like a blueberry, except they have the highest antioxidant of any plant out there. So we just said, okay, we'll try it because, you know, this is a culinary process that the inventor, Bobby Lafferty, is a classically trained chef. And what they did, they would use this technique to infuse these different flavors and stuff into oils, turmeric, you know, all this, anything that they, and then they would use that oil to do these high-end foods. So that was kind of where it started. And there's a whole story about how, you know, what happened with Bobby to get it into it. But when we talked to Bobby, we said, can we scale this thing up? And he said, yeah, the thing will scale up. So that was the impetus of the thing. We built it and worked better than what we ever thought it would. And the difference that, because I've done CO2 and ethanol, but this system basically preserves all of the cannabinoids and terpenes because it's a closed system. It's under heat and pressure. And so it infuses whatever's in there. So you could put hemp in there and then you could throw some ginger or chamomile or, you know, if you wanted to flavor it with anything, you could put magic mushrooms in there with it. And it would infuse that into the oil. And so, you know, the way it started out was with, like, say, you know, doing CBD into hemp seed oil. And now we're looking at all of these different things. Coffee, we can make cold brew coffee in 20 minutes where it takes 20 hours to do it the way they're doing it now. We can, the coffee bean has a shell around it that has a lot of phytonutrients in it that we can take out. And now this can be a value added for these coffee growers that are basically composting that stuff now, and it's cost some money. They don't know what to do with it. There's just so many things that we haven't even tried yet with this system. I think it's kind of reminiscent of Colonel Sanders when he figured out how to cook his chicken.
What's the website?
It's just a innovative way of, like, say, infusing anything into a lipid. But the thing that we found out too, accidentally, is that you know, we use water in the system as a propulsion agent, and we're just dumping it down the drain. and we tested it because we were thinking it's got smell like it had terpenes in it. So we tested it, and it had terpenes and cannabinoids in it both. And which it's not supposed to, it's not water soluble. Or, you know, it's not stable in water. And but we're finding it. So we took it to a friend that was doing all our testing for us, and he said, look, freeze it and dry it a few times and it'll drop out. It didn't. So he said, well, I'll put it in my high speed centrifuge, I'll get the drop out for you. He called back, he said, I don't know what's going on, guys, but it didn't drop out. And so he said, I got one more thing. It was some kind of high residence, something, equipment. And so he ran it through there, tested it, and called us back and says, guys, I don't know what's going on. He said, it's still there. And he said, the only thing I can tell you guys, you've broken science because this isn't supposed to be happening. And so we still have cannabinoids and terpenes stable in water. You know, it's like 6 or 8 months now that we've tested every now and then, and it's still there. So whatever we're doing is creating something that, you know, kind of defies science. But it's an exciting technology, you know, that it ended up being something that can be used and will be used in the cannabinoid part of the industry. And the food industry. We think the food industry is going to be bigger than anything. So that's kind of what we've been up to, you know, in the last few years.
Now, do you have a website for that enterprise, Joe?
Can you guys hear me, or am I just talking?
Yes.
Okay.
What's the website for that?
It's LipidBond, LipidBond.com, LipidBond.com.
Excellent. There were, so I know you had kind of shared the story about Woody Harrelson earlier on in the show. There was a few listeners who came a little late and were curious to hear about that. So make sure if you did join us late and you want to catch the story, it's definitely one you got to hear. I'm sure, Joe, you have plenty more stories like that that we're going to have to bring you back on, because you just really are such a precious, you know, holder of history. There's not many of you hempsters left that, you know, really can share these stories with us. And to me, this is like, you know, this is our legacy. And this is, you know, very... just precious, precious history. So thank you for being here. And if anyone in the listening audience, you know, you did miss it, make sure you go to iTunes or whatever your favorite podcast platform is, and you can certainly download the episode and listen to the full story.
And, you know, I've just about compiled all of the, information, and I'm gonna, because there are so many stories of, I mean, just funny stories, some of the crazy stuff that happened, that you know, I'm gonna write a book, and so there'll be a lot of the stories in there that that nobody's ever heard before.
Oh, that'll be amazing.
So,
well, Gerald, yeah. can you hear me okay now?
Yes. Yeah. No, I'm hearing you.
Okay. All right. Good. I think that these, like Milan said, these stories of hemp history are so critical to get captured and shared. So we really appreciate you sharing them with us. It sounds like your next steps are exciting.
I don't know if you
with
guys
your new
lost,
business venture,
Josh or not, but. Are you there, Milan?
Yes, I am.
I wonder what happens to Josh, but anyway.
Well, you know, you're talking about a lot of things on here. I always, you know,
yeah, but anyhow, Josh is, I think he can hear you fine. It's just, you can't hear him. So he's just reiterating how important your stories and your history are, and how much, you know, it's needed right now for us to really properly gauge our future. And really, we're just so thankful to have you.
Well, and I think it's, you know, the stories are fine, but I think the future, and talking about, you know, how we're going to make this industry survive and thrive in the future is the most important thing to me. You know, how do we make this a commodity in the next 10, 15 years?
Absolutely. And you made a good point too about, you know, how to secure contracts. I mean, you dropped a lot of really great gems just in this one episode. I think that we could certainly go back and look at and you know, dive deeper into some of these topics, because, you know, supply chain and, you know, pardon me, I'm a little out of breath. I'm walking right now. But yeah, there's just so much still that, you know, as far as structure and understanding, you know, best way to go about building out the supply chain, you certainly have a lot of insights on that. And I think that's where a lot of people are at right now, trying to figure out what's the best way to put, you know, their first foot forward and get into the industry without breaking the bank.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and you don't have to break the bank. You just have to talk to some of the leaders of industry and tell them about the great PR that you're going to have, and being the first out of the, you know, because the first people that come out and sign contracts are going to get the most PR, and everybody following them are not going to get the same PR that somebody like Toyota or Ford or you know, any of these companies that that jump on board early, you know, they're going to get the people are going to go, oh, I remember, you know, heck, Toyota was a leader out there. They were the ones that got all this started. They saw, you know, it's kind of like the 100th monkey thing. You know, once 100 monkeys do something, it becomes part of their culture. And so being out there first, and not without any risk, basically, is a attractive way to get industry leaders involved in this. So that's if there's any takeaway from it, to me, that's the thing, is being able to talk to these guys and have them lay out, you know, what their parameters are that would have to be met in order to move forward. And then once they do that, the industry can take off.
I think that makes sense. Absolutely. Joe. That's encouraging to hear that you're pushing forward on this innovation side and helping market this to the companies that will buy the products.
Yeah. It's imperative, because it's not going to start any other way. You're not going to have any farmers grow anything until they know they can sell it. They've learned their lesson over this whole CBD fiasco that they went through. And, you know, they won't do that again. You know, that was one of the things that I hated about the cannabinoids is, you know, when we first started, started a company here in Kentucky, and what we were focused on was fiber and seed. And then in late 2013, this explosion of CBD came up. And then all of a sudden, you know, we're like, well, let's grow this, let's build the CBD industry to create enough money to fund the fiber and seed industry. But little did we know that we were shooting ourselves in the foot, because everybody got into it. The same thing that happened in Canada in 98, when they legalized the hemp in Canada, the first year the farmers that grew it made great money. and all the other farmers saw it. And so the next year, all these farmers jumped in, and now there was this oversupply of hemp seed for 3 or 4 years, and it basically killed the market. So, you know, you have to worry about, you know, not oversupplying the market. You know, make sure you have contracts in place before you put any seed in the ground. And, you know, we don't want to go through this debacle of you know, because a lot of farmers lost a lot of money. You know, everybody lost a lot of money. Investors lost a lot of money, you know, chasing money. So, you know, that's a lesson that I think everybody's learned. And it's one that farmers definitely won't repeat. So unless they've got contracts, you won't get a farmer to put a seed in the ground.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people have learned a lot of hard lessons, and experiences. Sure, but it's not a we don't often learn lessons otherwise. So I am certainly grateful to have had this time to hear about what you've done and your vision, those many years back and your experiences. Joe, I know that Milan is likewise thrilled. She's on her way to an appointment. But it has been such a treat to have you here. I know that our listeners have appreciated this, and I look forward to finding ways to work together in the future and hearing more about your next ventures. The next time we have a chance to talk. So I want to thank you for joining us here at Hemp Rising and taking time out of your schedule to share your stories with us. And we look forward to hearing of your success and finding ways to advance the cause of the hemp industry together.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity too. You know, anytime we can you know, spread the knowledge out of where the industry is going and how to get there. You know, it's all to benefit for all the farmers. So, you know, thank you for what you all are doing. It's helpful, you know, to let everybody understand where we are now and where we're going in the future and how we get there. So I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Well, again, thank you so much for having us. For joining us and sharing with us your story. I hope Milan and I can get down and visit you here in the next few months and see what you're doing in person. And again, thanks for being with us. Everybody will be here next week, same time, 8 a.m. Pacific on Wednesday. Join us for Hemp Rising. You can download this episode and share it with your friends at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all your favorite podcast platforms. So again, Joe Hickey, thanks for joining us. We appreciate you taking time to be here with us on Hemp Rising, and everybody, we'll see you next week.
Okay, thank you again.
Thank you. Bless you.
Bye-bye.